introducing the two presenters. So Simone is head of risk management at Clearview Wealth. Her role covers risk and capital management of life insurer, dealer groups, a super fund, and a wealth management business. Simone began her working career at Old Mutual in South Africa in various actuarial roles before moving to the UK and working as an international benefit consultant at Mercer and then a risk manager at AXA UK, where she focused on Solvency II. Simone is fellow of the Australian Institute and the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries in the UK, as well as a member of the Institute's Risk Management Practice Committee. Greg probably doesn't need too much introduction here. Maybe he does. Greg has more than 30 years' experience in life insurance and fund management and is currently Clearview's Chief Actuary and Risk Officer. Greg's current responsibilities include overseeing the group actuarial, risk management and compliance functions and involvement in Clearview financial advice businesses. He's director of Clearview's two financial advice businesses. Prior to joining Clearview in 2011, he was a partner of KPMG and has held 10 appointed actuary roles during his career. He's been a member of various regulatory industry and professional committees and boards, advised regulators, and has published a number of insurance-related papers and articles. So please join me in welcoming Greg and Simone.
Thanks, Craig. So the way we're going to do this is I'm going to present and I'm going to answer all the easy questions and all the difficult questions Greg's there for. Right, so... let's start off. Let's just get all the technology going. Okay, so before I actually go into the detail of the paper, which I am going to assume most of you haven't read, but before I go into detail, I'm just going to digress for a few minutes. Has anybody ever seen the TED Talk by someone called Simon Sinek on how leaders inspire? I'm seeing a few nods. Okay, don't worry, for those of you who haven't. Simon Sinek, he questions how some companies and some people can actually inspire people, even though they've got the same resources as other companies and the same resources as other people. And what Sinek says is he talks about it in terms of he's got this golden circle. He says that traditionally the way we communicate is from this outside in. So we start with what you should do, then how you should do it, and then lastly, they talk about the why. But actually, leaders, when they inspire, they start with the why. They start with why you should do something. And then they go to the how and the what. Now, what Sinek says is that this is all rooted in biology. The what and the how, that is actually our thinking brains and our communicating brains. That's called our neocortex. And that appeals to that. Whereas our why, the why is actually our limbic brain. And the limbic brain is where things like behavior and feelings are. It's what you're talking about when you say something like, just doesn't feel right. So what he's saying is that those great leaders are inspiring by appealing to that limbic brain. And Sinek gives the example of Martin Luther King. So he says that, why did he lead the American civil rights movement? Why did thousands of people come out on a cold Washington day to come listen to him speak? So he says it's because he answered the why. So there were lots of other people who had been persecuted. There were lots of other people who were great orators. But why was it him? It was because he answered the why. And why what he said, they believed in. Martin Luther King said, I have a dream. He didn't say, I have a plan. And that comes down to the why. Now, this has absolutely nothing to do with risk management. But in some ways, we actually felt that maybe it has something to do with risk management. The idea for this paper came about one day when Greg came back from yet another risk management seminar that he had attended, where they spent a lot of time talking about the what and not much of the how and the why, or maybe a little bit of the how and not much of the why. And so when we actually thought about it and we thought about risk management, we felt like the why we do ERM, or in enterprise risk management, it's pretty clear. We kind of get why we do that. But more about the what we do in risk management, why we do risk management, there's not as much of that. There's a lot of the what, there's some of the how, but there's not much why. And maybe that actually comes down to our training as actuaries. You know, maybe we taught to focus on our thinking brains and our neocortex and not question things or think about more the why we're doing things. But we actually believe that if we do think about those things and we do question why we're doing some of the things we do in risk management, there's great understandings to get from risk management and the approaches. Now, we're not suggesting, there's no suggestion here of replacing any of the approaches that we have. We're not suggesting that. We're just saying, let's think about these things from a different perspective to try and get a better understanding of these approaches. So we've taken this theme throughout our presentation, and we've thought about risk classification, we've thought about measuring op risk, and we've thought about risk reporting. And we've come through those three approaches from a different perspective. So what? So why? Why do this? And for us, this other perspective has helped us. It's helping us to communicate risk, as it helps us to understand the behaviors of risk. It helps us to help the boards in developing their risk appetite. It helps us to understand why we're using different models for calculating capital rather than the different models that we use for the day-to-day risk management. And it helps us to communicate risk. And I'll come back to all of those a little more as my presentation goes on. So starting with risk management, risk classification, let's begin there. And let's see that the traditional approach has been we name or we classify risks, usually using their source. Okay, so now examples of that, so just to illustrate, you know, the risk associated with the market, so risks associated with the changes in the asset values, interest rates, exchange rates, they're identified, and we name these market risks. And then risks arising from failing to meet an organization's strategic objectives, we call strategic risk. But do we ever stop to question why we do it like that? Why do we name our risks that way? You know, is it maybe because it's simple? It's easy to understand that. It's easy to explain to somebody what a strategic risk is. Or is it maybe just a historical thing that we did it for so many years and then modern ERM came and we just carried on doing it? And what do these names actually tell us about how risks relate to each other, how boards' risk appetite is different for these different risks? They're pretty much not much. So we found it useful to rather think of it and take another approach, a different perspective. And what we thought we'd do is we'd question the behaviors of risks. And the way we do that is we'd split the universe of risks between different risk traits. And for a little bit of fun, we also decided to name them. Right. So there is our universe of risks. Nice and easy. So we split now that universe of risks. And one particular risk trait that we thought was quite interesting is those risks that give you an economic value for having or taking on, and those that don't. Okay? Now, these two risk traits and the management of them seem to us to be fundamentally different, and I'm going to go into a bit of detail about that. So those that generate an economic return are typically the risks related to the business. For example, for an insurer, that would be insurance risk. For a bank, that would be credit risk. Now, while these risks need to be managed, generally speaking, they are the wanted risks in the company, and more is better. So now, these risks also tend to be substantially repeatable. One may call them tractable or well-managed risks, and they are easier to model. Now, let's look at an example. Let's look at insurance risk. Now, insurance risk is based on people dying, people becoming disabled, car accidents, and that goes on an ongoing basis, so that what the insurer can do there is they can pool it, and they collect it, and they can price that risk. Now, if, for example, an insurer has a car accident, they don't stop quickly and call that an incident. They don't then start to investigate the root cause of it and then try and change it. No, they want to continue, and they want it to repeat. They do the exact opposite. They wanted to repeat the behavior so that they can price it and make profits from it. So for these risks, insurers do not want the underlying risk process to change. Insurers, they typically got their good data and the good modeling and the good measurement tools. And typically they have good risk management hedging tools, which allows them to either dial up the risk or they can dial down the risk, and they can try and get that optimal amount of risk that is right for them to the exposure that they have. Another interesting part about these value-add risks is that there's industry data, which is also typically fairly directly relevant and scalable on an individual organization level, because generally those risks are not materially changing between different organizations. So if we think of an example, the sum insured of somebody dying, whether you're insuring it with a very big organization or a small organization, the actual risk itself is not changing. There's a little bit of a chicken and egg approach here we found, that the risk that you can build a sustainable business on would generally need to be tractable. But equally, if you have a business based on certain risks, you're going to make damn sure that you spend a considerable amount of resources over time to manage and control those risks and to make complex models to make sure that they're tractable. So it's really what comes first, I guess. Right, so now I'm moving on. That was the value-adding risk. Now moving on to those non-value-adding risks. Now the non-value-adding risks are virtually the opposite. They have the opposite features. They generate no economic return or reward for being bad, and so they're almost the unwanted risks, and they're almost unavoidable. They're part of just doing business. Management of these, in our view, should be trying to be reduce them on a cost-benefit constraints. And any significant incident will usually actually lead to that risk being changed. So if you have a fraud, you're going to go back and look at your controls and try and change that and make sure that doesn't happen again. So you're actually changing that historical data. The risks are often going to be different from business to business. So, for example, a fraud can only be as big as the amount of money that you have in the business. So a very big organization is going to have a lot bigger one than a smaller organization. So when we thought about those non-value-add risks, to us, they're basically more of a traveling back in time paradox. So the better one identifies those risks, the more you change them, you control them, you mitigate them, and the less clear the residual risk is going to end up becoming. Those non-value-add risks are typically not easily modeled or measured or priced, and they're ad hoc, unpredictable, and they're non-repeatable. So they're quite the opposite of those value-add risks. And then when you think of it in terms of the board and their board's risk appetite to the value-add versus the non-value-add, you can see that the board should have a higher appetite for the value-add risk, and they're going to try to optimize the amount of the risk taken versus a lower appetite for the non-value-add risk and try and reduce them on a cost-benefit basis. Right. I think I've said enough about value-add versus non-value-add. Now, if we move on to a second trait that we thought was very interesting, let's consider those risks that impact an organization in isolation, which we've called entity-specific risks, and those that are likely to impact a number of entities, which we've named systemic risk. Now, systemic risks, by definition, are going to come from outside of an organization, whereas the entity-specific risks will come from either inside the organization or outside the organization, but only affect that particular entity. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Now, the board's risk appetite for this difference between the systemic and the entity is going to be significantly different. Now, when we thought about it, it's actually not that the board is willing to take on systemic risks, but more that they're not so comfortable taking on those non-systemic or those entity-specific risks. In our paper, for the one or two of you who have read it, in the paper we talk about the regulator's test. And this is where you say to the board, you know, what is your appetite for being called down to speak to the regulator? And their answer is, it depends. Are we alone or with the rest of the industry? Now, this is maybe a bit of a cynical view, but when we thought about it, it's actually what will play out in reality and practice. Because, as an example, if an insurer has some sort of a cyber event and they have policyholder information or data is stolen, the private data is stolen, what's going to end up happening in that situation? Well, the insurer is going to probably have quite a lot of reputational damage. The regulator is not going to be there to help, is probably going to even make an example of that insurer. Versus if we think of a systemic event like a pandemic, which is going to affect quite a few insurers, in that case, there probably won't be as much reputational damage, and you're going to probably find a very sympathetic regulator who's going to try and help the industry. And the whole industry together will probably put up prices, and they'll all get back to normal. And so, in a way, it's not surprising that boards are going to have quite a different risk appetite when it comes to systemic versus entity-specific risks. So now, as I mentioned, While the systemic risks are going to come from outside of the organization, those entity-specific risks could come from outside or within. And so we've actually realized that you actually deal with them differently, you manage them differently. And so when it comes to the entity-specific risks, we've actually split them between what we've called internal and external, what comes outside from outside the organization and from internal inside the organization. And so we end up with 6 risk groups, which we've given arbitrary names. Now, these 6 groups should capture the entire universe of risks. If we had a new resource coming about, they should be able to fit into one of these 6 groups. And let's look at these 6 groups in a little bit more detail, based on what I've said already. Starting with what we've called those beta risks, which are the value-adding systemic risks. Right, so now for these, insurers and probably for many financial service organizations, examples of them are going to be things like systemic insurance or liability risks, asset risks, liquidity risks, and asset liability mismatch risks. Okay? Now, the industry's got considerable modeling, measurement, management pricing, theories, frameworks, and skills in this space. A lot of time is spent in this space, especially actuaries too. They've also got established tools to manage those risks, things from traded tools like options and futures, or they've got some proprietary tools like reinsurance, over-the-counter instruments, and securitization. Next, let's consider those value-adding entity-specific risks, and we've split them between the external and the internal. Now, the alpha risks are coming from outside of the organization, those external ones, and the strategic risks are the ones that come from inside the organization. Now, the alpha risks are those that are from the entity-specific statistical or random experience attached to the beta. They include things like individual claims, asset performance, or liquidity risks within the insurance and the asset risks. These risks, like the beta, are typically well-managed by scale, diversification, tools such as reinsurance, and other risk-sharing devices. In contrast, though, you've got the strategic risks, and this is an area where there's little ability to hedge or to offload risks. The industry's got few measurement tools, and the frameworks tend to focus on more risk monitoring and establishing extra strategies. This risk management area is often significantly bespoke. Moving on now to the non-value-add risks. And again, we split the entity-specific risks between those that come from inside the organization and those that come from outside. The ones that come from inside the organization we've called operational risks, and the ones that come from outside the organization we've called resilience risks. Now, operational risks are those that comprise the internal business risks, and they come from the entity's execution of its business. Versus the resilience risks are those that affect a business in isolation, but they come from outside the organization, and they because of the business's profile. An example would be something like an external cyber attack or some sort of a local terrorism. Bless you. Many existing definitions of operational risk would include both these subcategories. That's what we're used to seeing. And indeed, they do have much in common, and we totally agree they do have much in common, but the organization's management construct of these two types of risks should usually be different, or we argue that they should be different. We hope they'd be different. And the difference we see is that while you definitely have mitigations and controls in place when it comes to your operational risks, at the heart of it, it comes down to the overall business culture and the behaviors and the capabilities and the vigilance of the individual people within your organization. You're trying to balance having controls, which is going to encourage people not to think, but it's going to give you those safety nets, versus the accountability, which is going to encourage that vigilance, but without a safety net. And you're going to have to try and balance those two. And it's complex, and there's no comfortable answer when it comes to this. Another thing is that operational risks are almost everyone's problem inside a company. They can affect everyone who works inside an organization. Let's compare those to the resilience risk. Now, when it comes to resilience risk, it's all about those mitigations. You're trying to put strong locks. You're trying to put well-maintained and tested fences and effective backups in place. The achievement of the risk mitigation for the whole business is actually usually only accountability of a few people within the organization, maybe some of your IT people or someone who's in charge of business continuity plans. So there's the difference to us. Just going on to our last group, which we have named the imposition risks, and they're the non-value-adding systemic risks. Now, they come from external action, usually the government or the regulators. This is the area of least ability to model, measure, or manage, or price. And there's generally no insurance or some sort of a risk transfer mitigation that you can use here. Solutions are going to be very bespoke in this case. Mitigations might be things like lobbying the government or regulators, or you're just going to have to monitor them. Okay. And after all of that, you might be saying, so what? Okay. So, as we touched on at the beginning of this presentation, looking at these risks from another perspective, we found to be helpful in our day-to-day jobs as risk managers. So we found that doing this and thinking about risks and classifying this way, another way, it helps our boards to assess and distill their risk appetite. You use these by using these groups. So they're not using names anymore. They're using characteristics and how their appetite changes on different characteristics. That also gives us a general construct that can easily be applied and extrapolated across all risks. It also helps us to think of the mix of processes and culture and controls we have and safety nets and mitigants and how we manage different risks that way. And it helps us understand and to explain to others why different approaches to risk measurement and modeling are effective for some risks but not for others. Now, before I move on and away from risk classification, just two observations that I'd like to leave you with. That line or those lines that I put before, the risks for every organization are not going to be the same on the same side of that line. Now, a value-add risk for one entity, for example, might be a non-value-add risk for another entity. Let's think of the example of a business that believes that they've got skills to add value when it comes to shareholder assets and investing them. They would see asset risk as a value-add risk. But there's other organizations out there that just see asset risk as something that comes with investing their reserves. And so they might not define asset risk as a value-add risk. It might be a non-value-add risk for them. So it's going to be specific to the entity. Secondly, the second observation that I'd like to point out, excuse my drawing skills there, I am an actuary, is there's a blurring between some of these lines. As an example, there's a blurring between what's systemic and what's non-systemic. And as an example, if you imagine an insurer who's providing a unique product in the market, they're being exposed to some effects of a widespread economic condition. Now, if they're the only ones that provide that particular product, then it might affect them in isolation. Do we call that a systemic risk? Do we call that a non-value-add risk? It's blurred. But in our opinion, in thinking about these things, an organization who actually thinks through these things and thinks of those points of differences and decides where they are in that blurring can actually add some substantial value by understanding their risk profile and their unique risk profile for their organization. And so I'm going to leave risk classification there and move on to measuring operational risks. Right, so back to our golden circle, just because it's pretty and it gives us some color in the pictures. Now, we've already discussed that the alpha and beta risks, they're pretty tractable risks, and so they're pretty easy to model. And so our presentation and our paper didn't deal with those at all. What we rather concentrated on are those hard-to-model resilience and operational risks, which we've grouped together just to call op risks, so it's not a mouthful. Now, when it comes to measuring op risk, there's two common approaches that gets used. You have stochastic models, which your technical risk managers use, and then you have the more qualitative models, which is normally a simplified impact versus frequency rating, which your day-to-day risk manager are usually using. But it seems to us that there's a little bit of confusion on how these two link. Now, the stochastic models, they're being used usually to calculate the capital charge. But it's hard to see how you would take that and then relate it to what the day-to-day risk managers are doing. On the other side, you've got this rating scale of using frequency and impact, which your day-to-day risk managers are doing, which is fantastic when you go into the business and you try and get your business to, you know, measure these risks. But it's quite limiting in what you get. You get that one number. You take your frequency and your impact, multiply them together in that one number. And how you then take that and you aggregate it and get a capital charge from that. So, we worked with the premise that risk management is not capital. Okay? Rather, capital is what you hold for your residual risks once you've done the risk management. And so we tried to come up with an approach that used the useful data that you're getting from your day-to-day risk managers within the business, but that could be aggregated to be able to calculate capital. We then tried to see how this would compare to the traditional stochastic approach of doing it. Okay, so our approach asked the business to provide more data points. And if there's more detail, our paper's got more detail on that, but I'm just going to give you a summary of it. So we go into the business and we ask the business to give us more data points than just the one impact and the one frequency. The way we do that is we fix the impact and we ask how often the business expects that to happen. And we do that with a few impacts and ask them in each case, with that particular impact, what do you think the chances of that of happening? This also is quite helpful because you don't have to just relate that impact to a financial. It doesn't have to just be numbers, that top one, the financial loss. You can look at other sorts of risk dimensions, things like the regulator, looking at breaches, losing licenses. You can also look at things like people, you know, losing a large amount of people or your senior management. So it doesn't just have to look at the financial loss. There are other risks to look at. Then what you do is once you've got those data points, you can fit a distribution, and then you can aggregate them. Now, we do note that there will be a lot of estimation error, and that when you're talking to the business, there's a tendency for them to underestimate the unknown unknowns, or what we've referred to as the dark risks. And there's a very interesting reason for that, if you just read the paper. The business knows what they know, and they know what they've seen, but they often don't think of those dark risks, those unknown unknowns, and so there is a tendency to underestimate that. So, then considered how this bottom-up approach actually compares to calculating capital using a stochastic model. So, on the right over there at the bottom, you've gone to your business, you've got your data points, you've fitted some distributions. You've now summed those individual risk assessment distributions, and then you think to yourself, well, it's not all independent, so we're going to have to put a correlation allowance in. So the next block up there is you have a correlation allowance. Then we're going to use this for capital, so we need to take some sort of account of the fact that our data doesn't really take account of those unknown unknowns, those dark risks. So we're going to put a dark risk allowance. Sorry, before that, there's uncertainty. We spoke about the parameter uncertainty, the estimation errors that you're going to get. So you're putting in an estimate or an adjustment for the uncertainty allowance. Then you put your dark risk allowance. And then actually you should take account of the characteristics that you have within your business, that the unique characteristics, things like the quality of your risk management framework or your risk culture. And you get a number for capital. Then what we did is we compared that to the stochastic approach to doing it. So what do you do in the stochastic approach? You take some scale data that usually is going to come from the industry, and you fit a distribution. Then, again, adjustment for the fact that the parameter are going to have an estimation error. So you add, again, that the green box there, the uncertainty allowance. Then, as I mentioned, those non-value-add risks, once they've been identified and changed, they're in the data, but they're actually reflecting something that happened in the past. So instead of trying to take those out, because those things have changed now, you've probably changed things, we rather use that as an implied adjustment for dark risks. But there's no telling really if that's enough of an allowance. And so we've added an extra dark risk allowance, which will probably be smaller than the right side dark risk allowance, given the fact that you have already taken account of some of those unknown unknowns. And then again, lastly, we've added the entity-specific adjustment for the risk management framework's quality and the risk culture. So we use this almost like a cross-check calibration exercise to see if that bottom-up approach is reasonable. And again, you might be thinking, so what? So this is just an approach to help you link what you're doing day to day within your business and your capital charge, and so that you have some sort of a link between them. It's just a way. Otherwise, I'd actually be interested in hearing what you think. Right, last one, risk communication. Now, traditionally, we produce risk reports with all the exposures to communicate risk. But a lot of that information is actually static and doesn't change a lot. And it's actually very hard to see in all of that data what the risk profile is or the risk status of the company and what's changing. And what you end up often having when you do it this way is a novel. And I'm sure, I can just see one board member here. I'm sure they can attest to the fact that they get novels. Right. So, we thought of looking at it another way. If we rather think to ourselves, how can we help the boards to distill what is the risk status of the company and what's changed? Then while we're still going to have that novel, if we add a one-page visual risk map, heat map, to the volumes, hopefully that can produce a risk report that helps the board easily distill what's going on. And as an example, so we've developed this one-page risk map, which we use to communicate overall risk status and what's changed. Now, this is just an example. It's a simplified one. But what it shows is in the middle, starting from the left-hand side, we start with our value chain. We start with distribution, then our revenue, our products, our front office, our back office, and our material outsourcing arrangements. We add governance to the top, and we add to the bottom the external environment. And we use a RAG status here, which is linked to our risk appetite to try and depict what the risk status is. And we also depict if there's been any changes since the last risk report. So if you can look there at the capital at the top there, you'll see that in the last risk report, it was green, and now it's changed to yellow. So what you're giving here is the board member a quick, easy snapshot of what is going on in the risk status and any changes, right? And the so what in this example is that it can help your boards to, when they're reading all that information, it helps them to quickly distill it to understand the bigger picture. Now, that's the end of my presentation, and I'm going to start losing my voice here. Now, if I can just leave you with one thing. For me, I think the biggest thing from our presentation is to say, keep questioning. Keep asking those questions why. We definitely don't profess to have all the answers in our paper in this presentation, but no great discoveries are ever going to come about if we just stick with the status quo. You know, if we keep questioning why we do the things we do, and we keep having those discussions and those debates, and we argue with each other, and we give each other different ways of thinking about them, even if they are left field, it can only help risk management. And that's me. Thank you.
Questions. In the spirit of continuing to ask questions, please feel free. Hop up to the mic, say your name, and on you go.
Richard Beecham, Vero Insurance in New Zealand. Simone, that was a tremendous presentation. Thank you very much. I'm not very good at remembering all of the types of risk and those hierarchies that we set out. So I think you've got some tremendous nomenclature. You've got a tremendous framework to use. At the same time, when I see the board, when I work with the board with our risk appetite statement, I'm not always certain that what we're writing down is actually the appetite that the board has. Have you used your new framework to test that the board is taking the risk that they think they're taking, and as a result have been able to create some change in your organisation?
I think Greg needs to speak.
I was hoping to dodge speaking. Yeah. That's no good. Yeah, we have. So our risk management framework actually is built, starts on the whole concepts of value add versus non-value add. So we do actually do that. We actually haven't taken it as far as this paper. This paper was a bit of a, you know, like naming all these risks was a bit of fun for us. We got no idea whether it's actually going to be a useful thing. But I'll give you an example of where it has been significant. So Simone and I both work for a little company called Clearview that's growing. We've got a long list of things we want to do, and execution is a big part of our day-to-day business and implementing things and trying to get things out to market. For our board, normally you'd put execution and IT and everything in the box of operational risk and treat it over there. For us, it's actually value add, because that's actually getting out in the market and all the rest of it. So we've actually had, using this sort of framework, actually have discussions at the board where the board has said, this is value add stuff. It's like insurance risk. You push right up hard against the risk appetite statement, risk appetite right up there to the limit. And, we'd rather be in the market 3 months early than 6 months late. And if it costs us $1 million because we stuffed it up, it costs us $1 million. Now, sorry, Clearview is a listed company, so don't actually take that as a real example. But I mean, that was one of those things that actually helps you crystallise what is your business, where are your risk appetites and where aren't they. And so we have in that, I'm not sure if I'm quite answering your question, but we have actually used it in that sense. So we haven't quite gone as far as we've got in the paper, but yeah.
But we will be. Our board will be our guinea pigs, and we will be using it in a few months' time when we revisit our annual board risk appetite.
Don't be shy. I actually have one question. One of the pieces that I'm very interested in there is the point that you made about the blurring of some of those categories and those segments. I'm really interested to just hear your thoughts on kind of some examples where you've seen that, and perhaps you've disagreed or you've really struggled to find specific risks that fit into one of those categories, and really just how you go about resolving that particular conflict. I think particularly in the context of boards, who I guess ultimately are the ones who really need to make those calls.
I don't think there's a right answer with some of them, to be honest. So I don't think that can happen. I think if you just, it's more the thinking process that goes than the actual answer. And so I don't think that there's often an argument or a disagreement. If you can think your way through it, whatever the answer is the answer. But it's the thinking that comes from it.
Yeah. Oh, no, Mike's got a question. But to my mind, there's no lack of examples in each six of those boxes. So I think someone even gave you some for every single one of them. So there's not a problem. And again, when you're talking to boards, inevitably you end up getting back to specific sorts of risks like fraud or compliance breaches or something, because people still need to touch those things and they usually express an opinion. But what we've been able to do is to say, okay, so therefore your attitude to this sort of risk means you're really risk averse or whatever in this box called compliance, internal, stuff up risk. If it's not that, and it's, like a fraud risk on the other hand might be more acceptable, but that falls into this sort of box. And so that's what we're saying. We can sort of generalise our risk appetite, and it is in our RMS. It does talk about, systemic, value-add risks. We have a risk tolerance on it, and then we normally have some examples next to that to remind the board what they meant, because they forget. It's just a different way of doing it.
Thanks, guys. Very interesting. Mike Thornton from AMP. So you touched on sort of there being quite well-established frameworks for categorising risks, and those have been around for many years. And I think there's a reasonably well-established body of academic theory on how to do risk management. Much of risk is now a minimum expectation of regulators. Do you think in that complexity is kind of limiting the use of risk management in the real world and in a commercial sense?
I suppose you're sort of touching on one of my sort of little frustrations, and it does. I don't know if there's any regulators in the room, but every time we have a new flavour of the risk of the month, there's a new requirement for a cyber risk framework and a cyber risk response, and then there was the fraud risk framework, and it does divert attention, and you know, so you end up responding to all these individual risks without an overarching principle of, you know, what ones should you actually deal together and which ones are actually different that you would actually require a different framework for. So I do find that endlessly, you know, new risk idea, new hobby horse, new something for a consultant to come and talk to you about because it was a great idea, and that's not having a go at a consultant, so I used to be one. But, you know, it definitely it distracts an organisation, and in the end it's not always obvious that it's just not another subset or another thing you should actually deal together. One of the things for this whole thing about the value add versus non-value add, some of you may know I'm on an international ERM committee with the IAA, and I just find it absolutely, you know, fascinating to watch actuaries talk about risk management, because they start at ERM and there's, you know, great, you know, optimization, maximise value stuff, and before you know it, you've either gone down into Copplers and whatever, into the old stuff we know really, really well, or we're into 15-page definitions of what operational risk is, and, you know, where the line is between an operational risk and something or other else, and you go, I'm not sure this is actually getting to the nub of what you do with it. Like, it's a great economic exercise, but I come back tomorrow and I go, now I've got a 15-page definition from the CAS, which is slightly different from the UK Institute that they've got. It doesn't help me. I suppose what we were trying to do here was to say, well, is there another way of cutting this whole pie to say how you do it? Yeah.
Jenny Lyon. So Simone referred to the fact, so I'm on the board of Clearview Nominees, so the trustee board of Clearview, so I get to see some of this sort of information, and I guess firstly I do find it very useful, and I do find that it, but I particularly like the fact that you can see what happened last time, so that I can go, okay, so this is where there's been change and why has there been change and what might I go and refer to. And the trustee board obviously has different risk profile in terms of what it's looking at and what's important to it, because from our perspective, it's protection of members' interests that's the most important thing, so that when Simone and Greg presented to us, they showed us, you know, the whole Clearview risk management framework, but also looking at it from the trustee board point of view. And I thought that was a really interesting way that you could then take that small part that we have and how that fits into your whole risk management framework, and it gives us comfort in terms of the way Clearview's performing, as well as that we are looking at the right risks from our perspective. Thank you. That was just a comment.
Thanks, Jenny. That's actually a very good point. I forgot to mention that. Thank you. This is just the one heat map, and we have a few that go behind this. So this is just the we do one for the overall for Clearview, and then each of the entities has its own heat map, and that's because, as Jenny says, you know, your different boards are looking for different things, and so you can't expect them to all see it in here. And so it's important for them to be able to see their own particular entity as well.
I actually found this heat map very useful for us, by the way, too, as risk managers, because it forces us, you know, rather than going through some checklist, it's a bit of a visual, and just helps us simplistically just think about the whole business. So it's all very, you know, it's easy as a risk manager as well. You get heaps and heaps of reports, and we get business unit reports with the top three things and what's happened and incidents and all this sort of stuff going on. This really helps when you start putting colours on a page and you go, oh, hang on, geez, a bit of a theme here. You're getting a lot of heat in the back office or whatever it might be, that you go, oh, actually, I need to actually step back and look for the wood for the trees as well, rather than having a whole, you know, we've all seen those dashboards which have lots of rag statuses and arrows going up and down with a little description, and it goes over a couple of pages. It's really hard as even somebody who's in the business to step back and see the wood for the trees as well. So I personally find that, I find it really useful when Simone presents that to me and I go, really? Which then I go, looking through reports and having a bit of a look as well, and then you step back and then we have a discussion, and sometimes you have to have a coffee and have a yelling match, and then we come back and that's all good. But it actually helps us really focus on what some of the what's really going on in the business as well. I must admit, this is mainly an operational thing, because in our day job, that's probably what we actually spend a lot of our time as risk managers actually doing, you know. Ash looks after the reinsurance strategies, and the investment guy looks after a lot of the investment stuff. What we actually look at on a day-to-day basis is a lot of the op risk stuff.
Hi, thanks for your presentation. That's absolutely fantastic. I'm Marilise Hill. I'm from Cominsure, by the way. Do you still go through that whole stepwise process in your risk management controls to go for, you know, what are the things that can go wrong, and therefore drilling down to what are the controls you need to have in place to stop those things from going wrong. And then my second question is, because that's sort of how we do it, but then I find that, well, as per your dark risks, I mean, often the things that go wrong are the things that you didn't imagine in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. No, so we've got the same. So we do still have risk registers. We have workshops. We sit with the with our business, and they identify their risks, and we go through that whole process. And you're right, they just think of the current risks. They don't think of the unknowns. And we've actually identified that and realized that we've spent a lot of time thinking about those risks, which I've been sort of calling our yapping dogs, because they're at our feet. We know those risks. They continually in our face. We can't ignore them. And we don't look up from them and actually go and say what else is coming. So we've now spending more time asking the questions. And the way to do that, we think, is to not bring out that risk register, to not mention the word risk, and to just talk to people. Take them out for coffee, take them out for lunch, and just talk. And that's often a way to try and suss out those dark risks.
So the only thing I'd add to that is dark risks are really important, but probably the more dumb one is if there's a risk you already knew and you didn't do anything about it, that's even worse. So, yeah, we still have the registers and we have the controls and we have all that stuff. Yeah.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question.
Hi, Brett Pickett, Suncorp. Just an easy question. How do you do the risk management framework risk culture adjustment?
Oh, look, that's largely at this stage. It was just to call out that, you know, in trying to compare what would be a capital charge calculation might be, which says I've got a bunch of data. If you're a bank, you would have fraud data and all this sort of stuff as well, as you'd have industry data, and you've come up with something, you know, that you should somehow make for example, on a capital sort of approach, say, well, do we think our risk culture is a bit better or worse than average? And so add a bit or take a bit off that. So the box on your left-hand side, although it was an ad for culture, it should be a plus or a minus, really, because you're comparing to industry average. So we're sort of saying you'd do that, you know, although someone presented that way, then this way, you'd actually probably do that first. Then you have your bottom-up approach, and you start looking at the gap and saying, well, why is it there? What reasonable things could I put on it? Does it make sense? And if I've got a model, then I can actually then start tracking that over time to say, well, I started at this point and now my identifiable risk has gone up and down, and do I think other things going? It's meant just as a bit of a tool to help you. There is no science to it. That might come in paper number two. But, you know, it's one of those things you look at and go, well, if my identifiable risks is 50 mil, and I've just done a bunch of calculations, and the dark risks and the culture and everything add up to 1 mil, I've probably not got enough there. On the other hand, if it's huge, you might start asking yourself whether there was something. Yeah, you know, it's just meant as a, you know, the usual way with actuarial stuff. Make it up and see how it looks like, and then see if it makes sense. Yeah.
Just cut that bit out.
On that note, if you could all just join me in thanking Greg and Simone for that very insightful session. Thank you.